Welcome to the 26th episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show. I'm Tema Frank, your host. I'd like to thank IBM Canada for sponsoring this show. Today's interview is a really interesting one. I was quite honored to be able to interview Mitch Joel, who's originally known best, I guess, for his book and blog, Six Pixels of Separation, and has recently released a new book called Control-Alt-Delete, Reboot Your Business, Reboot Your Life, Your Future Depends on It. I really enjoyed reading the book and found it quite thought-provoking, and it was great to be able to discuss some of the issues that he raises in the book. It's a fairly long interview, so I won't go into a whole lot of intro, but I will chat with you briefly at the end of the interview. Enjoy.
My name is Mitch Scholl. I'm president of Twist Image, and I've got a blog and podcast that I've been doing for quite some time called Six Pixels of Separation, and I've got a new book coming out called Control-Alt-Delete.
It's interesting you commented about companies starting to think, well, or now accepting that this isn't a fad, and yet I get the feeling that in Canada there are still companies that do think that just haven't really accepted that the world has changed. Do you see a difference with your customers or companies you talk to between the attitudes of Canadian companies versus American?
I do always sort of hesitate to say that it feels like Canada is a bit behind, because we are. So it's a hard thing to admit because you don't want to admit that. But I think we are rightfully so, meaning we're a tenth of the size of the U.S. We have a very sparse geography, right? Lots of people on border cities across, you know, a handful of major cities and then other cities. Culturally, we didn't really have the environment of the States, which is very, very big and very, very also spread out and then densely populated, as spread out as they are, where, you know, if you had a daughter going to a prom, I mean, the natural thing to do is to order the prom gown by catalog. You don't really have that culture in Canada. You sort of went down to the bay. You know, you went down to Eaton's when that was around, or Sears or whatever it was. And I don't know if the culture of sort of ordering catalog and all that, it was as dynamic as it was in the U.S. Also, again, shipping. If you look at what it takes to ship something in Canada, one is we have ground corporations or government-regulated corporations, so there's no competition, set pricing. It makes it very hard to be competitive. Shipping is complex in Canada because we have this big geography across a long distance. So you see some of the things that are obvious hurdles to seeing the mass adoption that make you think, oh, it's not so great. But the other thing is you sort of look at the world and it's happening. You know, we can't stop this. And so it's more a question of, you know, do you want to be disrupted or be the disruptor?
Yeah, it's interesting, your example with prom dresses. I actually have a daughter who's going to the prom this year, and she and all of her friends bought stuff online. Well, not all. There were some who actually flew to New York from Edmonton, which is kind of amazing, really. But those who didn't have that kind of budget, they all went online and bought from U.S. companies, from China, from wherever. So I think certainly Canadian companies have to get with the picture.
Well, and you see the other side of it too, which is, you know, if you look, and I'm a big retail nerd, you look at sort of like who's coming in, and you see things like Victoria's Secrets, which then acquired La Senza as an example, and look at what La Senza is. And I'm not saying anything negative about them. I actually know the founders and have a great respect for the brand, but it's a different world when the U.S. big guys start playing here. When the Crate and Barrels and the Williams Sonomas and the Targets come in, you see the landscape changes.
For sure. I think that certainly the larger Canadian retailers and increasingly, I hope, smaller ones are starting to realize that this is something they have to get involved in. Now, one of the things that seems to be overwhelming to a lot of companies is just the fact that marketing now, you have to be in so many different places at once. And one of the things that I really liked about your book is you talked about the future focusing on simplicity and utility. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
In order for a brand's message to get through, it doesn't solely rely on advertising anymore. And it may sound like a sort of obvious, well, duh, but it's not so obvious, because marketing in and of itself is a very big part and component of a business. And what's happened over the years prior to digital is the fact that advertising became the 800-pound gorilla in marketing. It really became the sort of the thing we – in fact, if you can go online now or even in trade pubs and see how often people are flip-flopping words, like advertising is marketing, marketing is advertising. It's like, couldn't be further from the truth. And I think what's happened because of digital and the power of the direct relationships, which is one of the trends I talk a lot about in the book, is the fact that suddenly it enables and engenders brands to connect to customers in a very different way. Two of the outputs of this, one is that simplicity wins, which is no surprise, right? You make the product very, or service very, very targeted and very, very relevant so that people really understand what it is in a simple way without jargon. But the other part is the way in which you can build loyalty beyond reason, real sort of connections, is by giving people something they would actually use. And I talk a lot about in the book about the power of creating a utility, this idea that it doesn't have to be an ad. You know, your app on your mobile device doesn't have to be a coupon or a when your store is open or a this is what we have on sale. It could be something that people actually would use. We actually don't use a lot of apps that are narcissistic for the brand. You know, look at us, this is what we're doing, what we're doing. But sure, we all use a ton of apps that provide us with the level of utility. But the bigger point that you're making is very valid, which is people go like, oh, I don't have time for this. If you have time to open the lights and the door for your business, you have to have time for this. Because there's just, I mean, it's like saying, you know, oh, I don't know, who has time to open the lights and the door to have this business run?
How, though, can companies engage in these personalized conversations in a scalable way?
Well, I don't necessarily know that they can. And not only do I not know if they can, I don't know if they should. You know, I think that there are a lot of instances where brands are trying to get as many people as possible to like and follow them. And what they're not realizing is that the consumer side of the like and following is really for people they know or sort of know or would like to know. And brands don't always fit into that mix. You know, a billion eyeballs doesn't mean you have a billion people who care about you. It just means that there's a billion people. I mean, finding out what would make them care about you in that space, that's the utility, that's the value, that's the hard work. And so I think conversation is a bit of a misnomer. I was all aboard the conversation train for a long time until I realized that I don't know if anyone's really having a conversation when I look at it. I think people put out things and those things come back and there's a bit of engagement back and forth, but I don't know if it's a conversation like, you know, you and I are having a conversation right now. I don't know if brands are really having that. I think they're having engagement. And I think what brands can do in these channels to make themselves more relevant in terms of that engagement is to forget about conversation and just think about making whatever they do as shareable and as findable as possible. Because if you make your stuff as shareable and as findable as possible, that means it has a social core to it. And if it's good and it works, people will share it and talk about it and make it more findable. And then you have a more social aspect to it.
So with making it as shareable and as findable as possible brings up another dilemma, though, that I think a lot of companies are in right now, which is with everybody producing more and more content, you kind of get into a vicious circle, because if you want to be found, there is this feeling that you have to be constantly churning out content.
And no, well, I don't agree. I think that feeding content because you need to be found is a surefire formula for failure. I think figuring out how to create relevant content that people want to talk about and share is something that will never grow tired. I think the mistake we see predominantly is that people are just looking at it as a quantity versus quality debate.
And yet, the search engines, it seems to a large extent, do reward quantity.
But search engines are playing a less important role in this. I mean, where do we, you know, you don't go onto Google to say where are the top marketing articles. You go onto Twitter and you ask, or you go on Facebook and ask, and people are organically and naturally sharing the links that matter to them. So are you better off using Google as the destination to find the best content in marketing, or are you better off following someone like me, let's say, who you might like, and you sort of share values, and you see what I share, and it's similar to what you like, and suddenly that becomes the sort of curation channel. So I'm not dismissing the power of search. I love search. I think it's a massive in terms of consumer intent and information. But I do think that that world of search engine optimization has been somewhat uprooted by the ability for people to share and find information through social channels.
So you think that our individual social networks are having continually increasing power?
Well, they're more trusted channels, right? Take a step back and be the consumer. It's never easy because we're marketers. But you take a step back and you go, I need a plumber. My toilet just exploded. Where do you think the best answer will come from, right? Local plumber on a search engine or saying on Twitter or Facebook, my toilet just exploded. Who knows a plumber?
Yeah.
I'm in, you know, New York City. I need a good place to eat in Manhattan, Lower East Side. Who's going to provide you that best response? Yelp or my social network?
And the difference, if your social network has ever been there.
Well, even if it's minor, it can be quite powerful. You know, when Tema gives me a solution to that problem, I'm going to treat it very differently than, let's say, when Seth Godin does. Not because Seth Godin is a more prominent figure, only because I would probably say, you know, Seth is a vegan, and I'm not really a vegan guy, but Tema is a real meat eater, and I'm a meat eater, so I'm going to trust your opinion more. So what we also have in the world is are the sort of human and semantic variances of what happens in that world, which is I'm not just going, well, everyone said eat sushi here. Right. I'm actually looking at it and going, well, you know, Tema sort of likes that TGIF family stuff, and I hate that stuff. So knowing she likes that, your opinion is actually less valuable to me, even though I know you.
Fair enough. So it sounds like what you're saying is in some ways similar. I was just reading an excerpt from Danny Brown and Sam Fiorella's book that's coming out, Influence Marketing, and they're saying that marketers or companies are making a mistake focusing on quote-unquote influencers, that they need to look at the actual customers and their personal networks versus the ones who are the tech columnist may tell you that the latest Samsung is the greatest thing ever, but if your friends are saying something different, you're more likely to listen to your friends.
I think there's a hybrid in the middle there, and maybe they talk about it. I don't know their book.
Yeah, it's not published yet, so I've only been able to read that one chapter so far.
When I'm looking at, particularly when it comes to products and brands, what I'm actually looking at is heavy users. I think my heavy users are both the best influencers and best barometers for what's working and what's not working. Okay. I think it's easy to be an armchair quarterback and say, I heard that sucks. I mean, you know, I've got young kids and we're deciding on schools, and it's the constant battle of so-and-so said that this school is like this. And I'm like, do they have any kids that go there? No, they go to this school. Well, maybe they're saying that because their kids couldn't get into that school and they're trying to validate their own decision. You know, you can sort of go down that very, very immediate corridor. And it's human nature. It's, I heard that sucks. I heard that's great. Well, you know, I like heavy users who actually know a little bit more about the product. We do work with one of the brands we work with is Air Canada. And not that it's because they're a client of mine, but I'm also happen to be super elite. So I spend a lot of time on those planes. And I think that when there is a question about the product, I believe I have a better answer most times than even the client does, because I know what that – I am that heavy user. I am that customer. I know all the intricacies of lineups and when it's, you know, lounges and things like that. That is me. So because I live the brand, I believe I'm better at explaining it. And I believe that when people have questions about a brand like that, I provide a higher level of response because I am the heavy user.
So how should the Air Canadas of the world be engaging with people like you? How should they be finding you, and how should they be using your expertise?
Well, the truth is I don't know that you always have to. There are certain brands and products and services that really don't require that type of engagement. I mean, it's just me. You know, I may not need much hand-holding beyond what I've got. You know, they want to throw me a couple of upgrades for service or give me a higher level of status or make it easier for me to accumulate actual status miles versus non, probably interested. But at the end of the day, it's not, at least for me, a product or service that requires that much engagement beyond make it easy for me to buy and enjoy the product.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it is. If you advertise something, product or service, B2B, B2C, and the product does what it says it does and delivers on the promise, and the price point is at such that I feel I'm deriving value for the exchange of giving money, home run. You know, it's a home run.
So why do you think, I mean, I've spent much of the last 15 years working on website usability issues, and we've made some headway, but there's still a lot of reluctance on the part of companies to pay for usability testing, for making sure their products are user-friendly. Do you see a change in attitude among your clients? Do you think that's a message that is finally going to get through? Because that certainly would be consistent with what you're saying, and yet I still hear even from a lot of agencies that they don't want to pay for usability testing.
Yeah, and I think part of the thinking there, which is wrong, is the fact that, well, aren't there already best practices? And I don't necessarily believe that there are. I think that there are certain companies that have done an exceptional job of making their products very easy to understand and use online. And then there are definitely archaic types of engagements that human beings have become used to because it's all we had that we think are best practices but actually really suck. And they'll make a lot of sense and aren't very logical in a world where the screen has now gone beyond the borders of the four squares of the corner of the screen. It sort of has become a more of an ambient, loose feel to it. So I don't know why that is. I mean, I'm always fascinated with brands that don't want to pay for, you know, user experience. I'm equally fascinated with brands that don't believe in testing, that don't believe in doing marketing optimization. And I mean, we live in a dynamic digital world where you can test two or three things every single day for next to nothing, and brands don't do it. And I think a lot of the reason why they don't do the things we're talking about is ego-based. Well, if the computer tells me I'm wrong, it means that I'm not good.
Yeah.
I actually think it's the opposite. I actually think if you come in and create a culture of always testing, we're going to test two things every single day and learn from them and make them better, what you're actually creating is someone who's saying, we have our vision to actually be great is through understanding the consumer better. But it's very much an ego human driven process that's definitely confusing.
That's an interesting point. And it sort of ties into my next question, which is, the challenge you comment in the book about essentially horizontal marketing versus vertical marketing, getting everyone in your company working on the same goals. And this is a challenge that I think a lot of companies haven't really figured out yet. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on what you were talking about there?
Well, it was this idea that marketing isn't this cost center that resides in some strange vertical, that as you sort of look at the world we live in, and you have a world where people will call it, you know, my friend Nilufer Merchant will call it the social era, other people will call it social business, so it's bigger than just, it's not just media anymore. I think all of those are valid sentiments. I don't know that many business cultures have embraced this idea fully yet. In fact, I would say most haven't. So it creates a massive opportunity to say, you know, in a world where everybody is connected and sharing through social graphs and things like that, how do we as a brand live in that environment when we have our – and it's not just because everybody's on lockdown and everyone has to follow the social media guidelines and policies the corporate affairs has pushed through the organization, but it's more about the fact that those individuals who work for your organization have smartphones. They are connected. They are sharing. They are customers as well of yours, of other brands. And how do you leverage all of that connectivity to create better brand narratives, to create better alignment? And so the point I was trying to make in that part of the book, which is actually one of the last parts, is just sort of one of the things I see happening, is this idea that perhaps marketing does wake up a little bit and isn't just sort of perceived as a cost center, but rather the place in which the brand narrative lives. And if it's where the brand narrative lives, that the tentacles of it, like an octopus or the legs of like a spider, go out throughout the organization and it becomes, you know, a more profoundly powerful center that touches all the other centers, that is involved in product and price and placement and promotion and, you know, the four P's, the basic things marketing was always supposed to do, but hasn't. You know, marketing really very much was pushed towards just make sure the brand looks pretty.
Yeah.
And that's not the real function that we serve.
Okay, I love that you said octopus, because the name, working name for my next book is Octopus Marketing. I also wanted to ask you to elaborate a little bit more on passive versus active media and how companies, I mean, you acknowledge in there that there will still be plenty of times where customers don't want to engage. They want to sit down and watch a TV show. And yet we're all focused on getting customers active and engaged. And, you know, my thought has always been, I don't particularly want to engage with my toilet paper beyond what I already do. Can you comment a little bit about that and where you think that balance will shake out?
You know, the idea was just in a world of, you know, what are we doing in social? What are we doing on the web? What are we doing in mobile? What are we doing in local? I sort of took a step back and went, this is like, you know, we talk about that overwhelming feeling for brands. It's very, very complex. And what I was trying to do is create a model by which we could simplify it. And what I also realized, we have a lot of consumers who don't want to tweet plus one, follow friend, chat, be a part of. They just want to watch TV. I talk about in the book where, you know, it does hit a certain point in the evening where I close the lid on the MacBook Air and I just want to watch Charlie Rose. And I'm happy with the media that's on Charlie Rose, whether it's content or advertising or sponsorship coming my way that informs me, because it's wrapped around a spectrum of content that I respect and like and enjoy. Conversely, when I'm on Facebook, I like the interactivity. I like the activity, the proactiveness of my experience where I'm more in control of creating, sharing, and doing things with content. And then when I see that little ad in the right-hand corner, I'm like, meh. It's like sort of less interesting to me because it's a very passive way of engaging with me. And so it led me to this place where I realized that it's interesting to see that a lot of brands who think they're being very digital are simply putting very passive types of content into an active channel, and then they're trying to sell advertising around it, and I don't know if it's that successful. Conversely, I don't know if you know, Facebook could create a TV show, if it would be all that entertaining to watch, you know? And so I believe that there are moments in time when consumers want to be active with media, Twitter, Facebook. They want to be passive with it. I just want to watch a show or read an article. And I think there are opportunities for people who are creating the media and advertising to think, well, if my consumer is just on the NewYorkTimes.com reading an article, what type of marketing message would work with them rather than annoying them? And so it's more about thinking about it, less about social and channel specific, and more about when is the consumer active or passive with media? How is our messaging in that active or passive? And do they equal up?
I mean, I see with YouTube, increasingly, there are enforced commercials before you can watch your video. So we are getting back to that pattern of blasting you with commercials, whether you want them or not.
Well, you know, I don't know. And I'll tell you why I don't know. I think what we're seeing also with YouTube is early days still. I know it seems like a long time since Google acquired them, but it's still early days because what I see is TrueView. And TrueView, the way it works is you might have seen this on YouTube where it says skip this ad in 4 seconds.
Yes.
So if you hit that button, what it does is you don't get the ad. It goes away. And then it tells the advertiser, you're not going to be charged for this. But you keep doing that, we're not going to let you run that ad anymore.
Yeah.
And what they're actually doing, I think, is much in the same sphere of what they did with Google AdWords, which was so great, is they are quickly building a funnel by which every ad you see on YouTube hopefully will be something that will be entertaining for you or part of the type of experience you're having, so that the brands right now that are just copying and pasting their TV ad and putting them on YouTube are going to feel the pain of having of having it busted down all the time.
Okay, so first of all, there are a couple of things I want to set straight. I am not a heavy meat eater, nor am I a vegan, nor am I a TGIF fan. So just wanted to make sure, in case you noticed that little bit, he was just using that as an example. And although I don't agree with Mitch on absolutely everything, I certainly agree with his view that simplicity and utility are crucial. If you want people to support what you're doing and what your brand offers, make sure that you make people's lives easier, not more complex. It was interesting. I was at a Pitch Fest event last night where one of the companies that was pitching and has actually received substantial angel investment was saying that what has made their products so successful is an absolute insistence on making the software that they provided super easy to use. And it was quite funny because the fellow who was chatting is an engineer, a software engineer by training, and he said, it's really, really hard for software coders to make things simpler instead of to show all the cool things it can do. But it was that decision to simplify that has really helped their business take off. I'm not sure I would discount search engine optimization to quite the same extent that Mitch does. Certainly, if we have friends who can give us a personal recommendation for a service provider or supplier of any sort, yes, of course, we're going to treat those a little more seriously than a random Google search. Nevertheless, a Google search and the ability that it has to link to reviews even from people we may not know is still a lot more useful than just an old-fashioned Yellow Pages listing. It still is definitely a place where a lot of people turn when they're looking for information. I think perhaps people like Mitch, who have a huge network worldwide, may forget that a lot of people really don't. And so many people, for many things, do need to rely on search engines. One of the things that I found really interesting was his distinction between active versus passive channels, and commenting that social media is by nature an active channel, and that that is perhaps part of the reason why it's difficult to be really effective with ads on social media sites, because unless there is some reason that they would choose to engage with that ad at the time, it's really just a distraction. whereas brand-based strict advertising can still work on a medium like TV, which is by its nature a passive medium. There, what it's about is engaging people, perhaps at a mental level, getting them to see it and think about what they're seeing, or even if they don't think about it, blasting them often enough that it sticks in their brain, but they don't have to engage with it. And even though there are a lot of people who are texting or on their iPads while they're watching TV, I think the dream that a lot of vendors have of people sitting and buying things on their iPads while they're watching stuff on TV, that's still probably a pretty small minority of the population. And I think Mitch's discussion of passive versus active really helps explain why that is. I think that's really all I need to add to today's interview. I would really recommend that you go out and get a copy of Mitch's book. I will have a link to it on my website. And of course, you can find all the interviews as well as a short version of this interview. Although if you got to this point, you probably don't need the short version. But anyway, you can find all that stuff at frankonlinemarketing.com. I would be really grateful if you would go to iTunes if you get this podcast through them and rate the podcast and perhaps put in some comment. Doing that will really help other people find out about the podcast. And if you've got any questions or comments or feedback, I'd really love to hear them. You can email me, Tema, T-E-M as in mother, A, at frankonlinemarketing.com, or you can telephone. There's a toll-free number. It's 1-866-544-9262, or you can leave a voicemail or a contact message at the website. Talk to you next week. Bye.